Thank you. My name is Howard, and I am an alcoholic. Gilbert, Arizona. Many of you don't know where Gilbert, Arizona is. I had Kenneth introduce me as being from Gilbert so I could explain it to you. Do you know where Scottsdale is? Well, Gilbert, $350,000 southeast of Scottsdale. I wrote that joke myself. I will, as I'm talking, watch my watch. I don't do that to see what time it is. I do that to give those of you that are worried about it a sense of optimism that I care what time it is. I don't really care because I know that my talk is going to last about an hour, more or less. Not much more. However, I'm the only one that knows when my talk actually starts. It hasn't started yet. One of the advantages and also difficulties of being the Sunday morning speaker is you're scared all weekend. You know, people say, I wish that I could be as calm and comfortable speaking. I am scared to death. My heart beats fast. I can hear it. That's about all I can hear is my heart beating fast. The Sunday morning speaker has had a lot of people be very nice to them all the way through the weekend. And you want to thank everybody, and you can't hardly think of your name, let alone everybody else's name. But I didn't get to know Kenneth well. But we noticed each other through the weekend, and he has a niceness about him, a goodness, a humility that I like, and that I know you guys like it too. And I want to thank Rhea for asking us to come, and anybody that had any influence on you and making that decision, thank you too. Doug has been a great committee man in that he kept us informed all the time, generally by messages on our. Doug kept us informed, and Dan became our host, and he and his wife had us over for dinner Thursday night. She's the best cook in Atlanta. We just had a great time with them, and he was the kind of host that is particularly good because he does not take you hostage. There are those that do, and I love them too, but he holds you gently. And, you know, and kind of like like Kathy in her talk said, just blows you away gently. John C., you see, these are people that I have a history with. This is a great thing in AA. I am connected. And John and I got connected some years ago, I'm going to start calling him my brother Ho Ho Ho. But we love each other. Bob Besantz and I love each other and have for a long, long time. Lyle P., I met him, way long time ago in Crested Buttes. It's a hell of a week. I heard him talk, and I learned a lot about myself from listening to his talk, and I think that's a big thing in AA. And with all of this, you see, I am connected, and all my life I have not been able to get connected. And I love these guys, and I learned in AA that love isn't standing apart gazing at each other. Love is standing together with the desire to share mutual objectives. And in AA, that's that we share sobriety and a happy, comfortable life with each other. And we'll go to any length to help each other do that. And that's not just saying I love you. That's the way we live our lives. All of us live our lives that way. And that's living a life of love. Speaking of living a life of love, my life of love also, thank you for letting me bring my wife with me. Very important to me that my wife comes with me. She comes a lot of times when she's not a guest of the committee, but she's a guest of the committee now, and that's, anyway, it's important that she's here because I have important things sometimes that I need to discuss, and without her, I couldn't do it. Now, if you look at your sign up here, happy has an open P, two open P's. Now, when Pat and I were in the fourth or fifth grade, there was a time when you were taught to make your P's that way in our lifetime. It lasted for about 2 years. I think they called it the Palmer method. I'm not sure. Maybe it was the Cuppy method, but there was some method. And I've been trying to get Pat to work. We do important things like have her think about whether that was the Palmer method or not. And when she says, I don't remember and I don't care. Oh, God. Anyway, I love Pat. And she loves me. And our life is good. And much of the goodness comes from getting invited to come to Atlanta, Georgia, and see people I love and share my new life with you. My new life's getting old. And probably my story about my new life is getting old too, but not for me. It's new and it's exciting every day. I was also when I talk. For the newcomers, if there are any new people here, I'm sure we all know this, but speakers are not authorities. As a speaker, we share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. The big book is the authority. And in order to add credibility to my talk, I make up stuff and say that it's in the big book. I give page numbers, and nobody ever checks. After I talk, I hear people say, well, he wasn't much of a speaker, but by God, he knew that big book, didn't he? I'm a native of Los Angeles, a town called Alhambra in the San Gabriel Valley, but the first home I remember was a two-bedroom apartment type thing that was attached to the back of the barber shop in this little town in Kansas, about 45 miles southwest of Wichita. And what I had believed all my life was the Bible Belt. Since I've traveled to different places in the country, I found out that everybody thinks they're from the Bible Belt. You know, the people in Georgia think they're from the Bible Belt, the people in Virginia, the people in South and North Dakota. Well, not everybody. The people in California know that they're not from the Bible Belt. And they're happy with that. They do not want to be in the Bible Belt. But anyway, nobody knows where the Bible Belt is. But I know it buckles about 45 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas, in the Methodist Church. In a town where I saw a travelogue movie when I was a kid, where they trained wild elephants. And they took the baby elephants out of the wild herd, and they trained them first by putting a big rope around their right front leg. And they snubbed the baby elephant up to a huge tree and put the other end of the rope around the tree, and the baby elephant fought the rope and fought the rope and fought the rope and fought, could not get loose. Over the long haul, it came to believe that it's futile to pull against the tight rope. And it stopped pulling and stopped struggling, and the trainer went ahead with the rest of his training. Now the training continues with the elephant for a lifetime. And this belief that it's futile to pull against a tight rope is reinforced so that they never forget it. And in the movie, at the end of the movie, the big elephant is pushing trees over. And they're hooking the tree up to a harness on his back, and he pulls that tree out of the forest so they can harvest it. And at lunch, in order to hold it, they put a rope around its right front leg, and they take a relatively short stake and drive it deep enough in the ground that when they wrap the other end around the stake, the rope will get tight on the big elephant's leg if it tries to wander around, and it'll stop. It can't pull against the tight rope. It knows it's futile to pull against the tight rope. The stake isn't holding the elephant. The rope isn't holding the elephant. The limiting belief that was imposed on the elephant when it was a baby is what holds the elephant. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with approximately 975,702 baby elephant beliefs just like that. Stuff I didn't know I had come to believe, but which affected my life and my behavior all my life, and I could never make it work. And I can look back, you know, and the newcomer, an AA talk basically is a retrospective thing. Because what's going on in my life in the moment, I have no idea. But at some point in time, I can look back and say, oh, that was what was going on. And I had no idea that my life was hampered with baby elephant beliefs. And but in retrospect, I can see it. I'm going to add something to my talk that I don't normally do, and I'm going to make up grapevine articles. And they're going to be easy to check because this one is in October 1967. It's by a doctor named Stanley Gitlow, and the title of the article is A Pharmacological Approach to Alcoholism. And Dr. Gitlow, at some point in this article, proposes that alcoholics as a class of people have a biochemical defect in their central nervous system that kind of throws the calibration of how they feel or throws how they feel out of calibration with what the hell's going on in their life. The normal person sees a problem, feels anxious about it, solves it, the problem goes away, and then they feel good. Well, if things go good, they feel good. Not so for the alcoholic, Dr. Gitlow proposes. The alcoholic has a biochemical defect so that when there is no problem, he's in a state of low-grade alert. At the very best. And he knows something's going to go wrong, and he's looking for what it is, you know. And he never feels good. And for me, you know, the things that I was taught about goodness wasn't good enough for me to overcome with my new belief system. This, on page 45, it says, lack of power is our dilemma. See, I lack the power to make my life work. I lack the power to feel good. In and of myself, I couldn't feel good. And I was trying to make this baby elephant belief system. But see, I was taught, one of the beliefs I was taught that didn't work for me at all, although I didn't know it, was that I was separate from God. When I was a little kid, I was told I was in this little Kansas farm town and God was in heaven. Well, right there, not having just got off the turnip truck, I knew I was separate from God. If they would have said he was in Wellington, Kansas, I would have known that we're not together. Now, he had a series of tattletale angels flitting back and forth and monitoring my behavior and putting it in the book. And God was saying, boy, am I going to give it to him, you know. And I was feeling that way, and when I was taught that I had to make my life work. These are things that kind of, without me knowing it, became mantras in my life. You put your shoulder to the wheel. You put your nose to the grindstone. The devil, no less, is going to take the hindmost. The little train that could, you know. And quitters never win and winners never quit. All of this stuff meant I had to make my life work. And I had to make it work with the dad who's saying, you're never going to make your life work. You're not any good and you ain't going to be any good. He thought that motivated me. He also thought beating the tar out of me motivated me too. He only beat me twice. Once was enough. Once was too much. There were six of us living in this two-room apartment behind the barbershop. Mom and Dad and my brother and I shared the bedroom. The wall between us was the washing machine and the tubs. We were not wealthy, but we didn't. Well, I knew we were poor, but I seemed to be the only one that knew it. And Dad had a lot of stuff to do rather than to take care of some smart-ass kid, and so he'd just whip you. And he'd whip you hard. And that don't make you an alcoholic. But I'm here to tell you, I never got where I like being whipped. Now, there are people, I understand, in California. But I am not one of those. I don't identify with those people. You whip me, and I ain't gonna like it. I don't like it. So I never felt good. I didn't feel good about the kind of student I was, etc. And then I was 12, and I remember believing. You see, we had to make our life work. But in times of adversity, we could beseech God in prayer to help us go through difficult times. And I remember the first time we beseeched God, when I knew who I was praying to and what I was praying for. And we were praying for it not to rain, because the farmers were going to start wheat harvest the next day. You can't harvest wheat in a muddy field. So we did not want it to rain. We asked God Sunday morning, don't let it rain. It rained. It hailed. It destroyed most of the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas. And while nobody pointed the finger at me, I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't doing what you have to do for God to answer the prayer. And I believed all the rest of you was doing the stuff. So it was my fault. Now, if you're 4 or 5 years old and you've assumed the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. You know, you can feel awful guilty and just be immobilized with it, you know, because of your ego. And I always had to do more than I could do. And I certainly couldn't do stuff well enough for me to feel good. I wasn't a good enough student. I wasn't a good enough son. I wasn't a good enough friend. I wasn't a good enough anything. When I was about 12 years old, I drank about a half a pint of whiskey. And I felt good. I was very conscious that this is a good feeling. This is what they mean when they say, let's go have a few drinks and get the feeling good. And that was a baby elephant belief that stuck with me, see. That was a new baby elephant belief that this is the way to feel good. And that was the way I felt good from then on out. And that was the way I was somebody. That was the way I could, you know, be. And I met Pat when we were in the 7th grade. I fell in love with her that very day. And I've loved her ever since. Except for when I hate her. And she was my girlfriend in the summer between, for just a few days, but I really loved her, between the 7th and 8th grade. And then I was an anathema to her, and she would, she didn't want to get in any trouble, and I was in trouble all the time. And sometimes we'd talk, and she said, why do you cause yourself so much trouble? I'd say, you're a phony. And I'm not a phony. You act like you like life. You act like you like this town. There's no way you can like this town and not be a phony. But she did like that town. She really did. She had a great life because she made a great life for herself. And my only greatness in my life was drinking whiskey. And loving Pat, who wouldn't have anything to do with me. That was not a great thing. When I was in the Navy, I heard her and her boyfriend, her fiancé broke up, and I went home for this primary purpose. Excuse me for just a second. Now I lost my thought. No, I didn't. I went home to marry Pat. Not to marry her, but to let her know that I loved her. And we got married before I got out of the Navy. And we were married 20 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was always after me, not to drink. I'll bet you a million times she said to me, don't you think you've had enough? And I'd think about it. No. To be honest with you, I don't think I've had enough. What the hell are you going to say, you know? Nothing like rigorous honesty. let me have yours. If you don't, if you're not going to drink that son of a bitch, get out of the way. I cuss. Pat, don't like that. I'm trying to watch my language, but it slipped through. I had fun drinking. Pat, we got married, and we fought, but things were doing all right. And I got a job as an engineer, an entry-level engineer, I think in 1959 or someplace around there. And it was a good job, and I was good at it, except I couldn't write technical reports. And I would try to write the report, and I couldn't write it. And because I couldn't write it, I would seize up and just be immobilized with anxiety and failure, not being able to do it. And one Wednesday, I hadn't even started on the weekly report. So I took the report, it had to be done Friday morning, so I took the report home to work on it at home. And I was doing it I'd never done that before. But I couldn't get started as usual, and without any thought about it, I went to the refrigerator to see who was in there to help me. And we had had a patio party the week before, and one of the Navy chiefs had left a bottle of whiskey. It was a pint bottle, and it was about half full. See, I'm optimistic. I heard a comic the other day say the cop that arrested him was a pessimist. He thought the bottle was half empty. I poured myself a drink. And I sat down, and it occurred to me crystal clear, why don't you start the report with a brief introductory explanation for why you did the analysis. And then in the body, describe the most significant things that were revealed in the analysis, and then conclude the report with any recommendations that make sense in light of the analysis results. I wonder who got the rest of that whiskey. I drank that, and then I wrote the report, and I'm telling you, I discovered a technical vocabulary that I didn't know I had. I had no idea. And this, I mean, it was magic. I took this to work, and everybody approved it. And in the middle of the next week, my boss's boss came out with my report in his hand. And he said, did you write this, Howard? I said, yes. He said, I knew you could do it if you'd just give us the effort. And I remember thinking, effort your rear end. It wasn't effort, it was whiskey. But I knew, don't tell him that. Let him think effort. The important thing was I knew it was whiskey. And whiskey it was. And from then on out, any report writing was done. And I discovered in a little bit, you don't have to wait till Wednesday night to start this process. You can start it any day at lunch. And then you can start it any time of any day. It's lunchtime someplace. And then there's just more and more things. And you get promoted, you know, and you get more challenges, so you drink more whiskey because there's more opportunities and more need for this, and it works. I went from a entry-level engineer to an engineer to a senior engineer to kind of a senior engineer, a Hughes and Nim engineering manager, and I didn't do that. I mean, that's not setting the world on fire, but that's a steady series of progressive promotions that I got because I drank whiskey. And I got the last one because I had learned to take bennies. Most people don't even know what bennies are now. They call it speed, but it was Benzedrine. Benzedrine and booze solved every problem in my life, or, you know, every problem I had except controlling my body functions. That particular combination caused you a little problem there, as a matter of fact. But now my boss, you know, pretty soon you get where, at least I did, I got where I had to drink so much to get smart that my speech was slurred. Right as I was getting smart, I'd start slurring my speech. My wife thought I was drunk. My boss thought I was drunk. And you can't, they cannot understand that I can't stop this. I've got, if I'm going to do good work, I've got to do it. Pretty soon, the good work isn't coming, and they can't make the bad good work come. And so I'm demoted. 1972, I was demoted for the 893rd time. Pat was going to leave me. Asked her not to, and she didn't. For the 892nd time. And I tried to cut back and I tried to control it. And I couldn't, and I would get completely overrun and I'd have convulsive seizures. Or I had a doctor diagnose me as being acutely intoxicated with probable alcoholic neuropathy when I told him I didn't drink at all. How I found out that that's what he said was I went back afterward to make amends to him and tell him that I said I was drinking a lot then, and then he showed me on the medical record where he had written, this man is acutely intoxicated with probable alcoholic neuropathy, when I was storming out of his room, you know. And I did this with Pat always taking care of the budget, always taking, and I had an allowance, but my allowance wasn't enough, was not enough to take care of what had to be taken care of. But I had a Bank of America card that she didn't know about, and I had a credit union at work that she didn't know about. And through some very shrewd thinking on my part, I ended up owing them $2,500 that she didn't know about. Now, if you take that in today's numbers, that's roughly $25,000. How would you like to owe $25,000, which you had no capability of paying, and your wife didn't know about it, and you didn't want her to leave you? And you had to, God, you got to drink. How else can you do this? And while I was on the drunk, I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before the owner lost it. I got it out the guard gate. I got it to a fence. The fence is going to sell it. 10 days later, I'm sitting in the tattletale trying to sell some more test equipment without the fence. See, the fence, I couldn't find him. I didn't get any money, but I needed money. I was in the equipment business now. And the next morning when I woke up, I know we all know some mornings when you wake up and it's not a sudden awakening or anything like that. It's a very gradual thing. And you realize, God, I shouldn't have said anything in the tattletale about selling test equipment. They know I'm stealing. damn, that equipment I took wasn't owned by Hughes, it was owned by the federal government. And its value exceeds the amount that will result ultimately in an investigation by the FBI. And I'm a candidate for hard time in a federal penitentiary, and my kids are a candidate for the disgrace that goes with that. And my wife. And I've got to stop drinking until this blows over. The only time I get in this kind of trouble is because I drink, and I'm not going to drink until this blows over. And I don't know how in hell it's going to blow over, but I'm gonna hide out. And when Pat was going to get a divorce the last time, she went to an attorney. Some attorneys deserve the title counselor, because this guy said, you don't want to divorce him. Hell, you guys have been married since you were kids. He sounds like an alcoholic. Why don't you get him to go to AA? She come home and said that to me. I said, Pat, AA is for people where their drinking has got their life in trouble. Why are you talking to me about AA? And whatever you did was wrong. I called the guy that I believed was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous Worldwide, a guy named Kenny S. I-X-B-U-R-Y. I'm either too close to this or too far away. I don't know where. And I called Kenny and asked him if he was in AA, and he was. And would he take me to a meeting? And he would. It was a beginner's meeting. And he said, are you drinking now? And I said, no, which was the truth. I had just finished a half a pint, and I'm not drinking now. And he said, try not to drink anymore. I had a long time in putting that together. But I drank four more half a pint. I took a lethal dose of speed. And so by 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, I didn't know what the hell I'd called AA for. Things are not that bad. I hope this guy don't come, but he came. First thing I told him when I got in his pickup, which was just what I thought the president of AA would be driving, I got in the pickup and said, I am not an alcoholic. He said, that's all right. Get in. I think we're going to the right place. And he took me to his home group, which became my home group, which was the Culver City Studio Group, which is the oldest group in West Los Angeles. And these guys were raised on the big book. Some of them were kind of anti the 12 and 12. But they were very much big book people, although they didn't talk much about. Basically, we got the steps from chapter 5, just as they are. As some people say, they put them on the wall, and if that's how you use them, you've got an off-the-wall program. We used the steps as described there, along with the 12, you know, but not in the home group, because in the home group, they shared. And this first meeting was a beginner's meeting. And the way the format was handled, they would say, is anybody here for the first or second meeting? And because my hand went up at just being my first meeting, I didn't know it, but the whole format changed and focused on what is alcoholism and how do we stop drinking? And they called on Chuck Ennis, who talked about editing at MGM, editing film, and stopping at the backstage bar on the way home. and just to have one drink, two at the most. Next thing you know, it's last call for alcohol. And I'm thinking, man, I'm just like that guy. You know, I've done that 1,000 times. If that's alcoholism, I'm an alcoholic. Then he said, that's alcoholism. He said, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned that I do that because I have an insane, obsessive belief each time I stop that, by God, I'm just going to have two or three. It never occurs to me that I'm not going to have just two or three. And he said, the insanity of it is, once I start to drink, there's a physical reaction that manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving where I have to keep drinking. And the insanity of it is, Tuesday after work, I'll stop by the backstage bar, never even thinking that it's going to be like it was last night, because he said the insanity is so great I can't even bring last night into my mind. It just doesn't enter in my thinking. And I'm thinking, do I know this guy? You know, I know this guy. Except this phenomenon of craving. I don't think I ever craved a drink. I don't remember craving a drink. I remember this movie with Ray Milland when he was standing outside the bar at like 5:30 in the morning shivering, and they finally let him into the bar and he tries to trade his typewriter, which he's a writer, and he's trading his typewriter for a drink. This guy is craving a drink. I never did that. So I don't remember craving a drink, and I talked to Kenny at the break, and I said, well, I'm just like that. And several of the other guys shared just like Chuck did, and I could see me, except I said, I don't remember craving a drink. Kenny said, when did you start drinking? I said, about 6 o'clock in the morning. He said, why did you start at 6 o'clock in the morning? I said, to get rid of my hangover. I always had a hangover. He said, how much does it take for you to get over a hangover? I said, a couple double shots, or about a half a pint. And he said, after you had that and the hangover was gone, did you keep drinking? I said, yes. He said, why? Well, I said, I wanted to drink, but I didn't crave it. He said, there's a class of alcoholic in AA who, once they started to drink, kept slugging them down so fast that the craving didn't really have an opportunity to set in. I thought, that's me. They started the second half of the meeting. They read from the bottom of page 93 to the top of page 94. No use looking it up, it's not there. It talks about the protege. And let him ask you how this works if you want. They read that part, and that thing says, but emphasize to this guy, whatever your concept is of God, it is your own personal concept. He doesn't need to share that with you. I decided I was an atheist. And I told my sister, who's a member of the Church of Christ, now, I don't know much about the Church of Christ, except they're hard over for Jesus. And she said, I knew you'd be an atheist. You're studying science, all scientists are atheists. Look at Dr. Einstein. Well, at that time, they were doing things experimentally, which was validating thoughts that Einstein had around 1915, just pure thoughts, impossible things to know that he knew. And experiments were being performed when I was going to school that proved the rightness of him, and I was amazed at that. And I was thinking, if that guy's an atheist, I don't need a better authority to support my atheism. So I got it in a book that you can get in the bookstore today. It's called The World as I See It by Albert Einstein. And in that book, among many other things, Dr. Einstein, there's not a formula in the book. It's a book on the world as he sees it. And one of the things he saw was that he was a deeply religious man in his own way. And I thought, well, hell, if he's not an atheist, I'm not an atheist. And I set about developing my concept of God. Well, it was a long time coming, although I could sit in the bars and tell you what Dr. Einstein and I believe. But the day came when I wanted to join this fraternal organization, which I didn't know anything much about, except my dad was a member, had been a member, and I asked somebody to carry my petition, and they asked me if I was an atheist, and I said no, but I thought I better, and I developed a concept of God that made sense to me. And they didn't ask me, but I had this information. At the end of the meeting, one guy had talked about his higher power being a doorknob or a light bulb, and he had stayed sober with that higher power. And another guy said his name was John. They call me John the Baptist. Yeah, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. They also call me John the Baptist because Jesus Christ is my higher power. He is my Lord and Savior. And every morning when I wake up, I ask Jesus to help me stay sober today. And as I go through the day, I thank him. And at the end of the day, I thank him. And he said, I'm grateful right now that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me Jesus back. I would have found Jesus again through AA. And I thought, well, now that's good for John. But I can't live in that fantasy. I have to live in the real world, which that day was 4 half pints of whiskey and a lethal dose of Benzedrine. I don't care. That's what I thought. At the end of the meeting, old Leo has John the Baptist in the corner, and he's telling him, don't bring Jesus into the beginner's meeting. You're going to scare away the newcomers. And I wanted to, I only now wished I would have gone over and said, hey, if you ain't going to scare them away with the doorknob and the light bulb, I wouldn't worry so much about Jesus. I got in the truck and I told Kenny, well, I'm an alcoholic, but AA won't work for me. He said, why is that? He smiled. Why is that? And I said, well, it's all that stuff about God. And your steps provide for prayer, and your steps provide for changing your behavior in some way that pleased God and enriched your life. And my concept of God, which you say will work for me, if it makes sense to me. And what makes sense to me is, God is the immutable laws of nature. And inherent in the laws is unlimited intelligence and power, so that things happen exactly in accordance with the requirements of the law. Certain atmospheric conditions are going to result in rain, whether you pray for it or not. See, that let me off the hook for having wiped out the Kansas wheat crop. the fact is, that made sense to me because I don't believe I ever had a prayer answer. But I was always praying for it to rain or not to rain or some damn thing that you do. Then generally it's going to be the laws of nature that unfold, and they don't change because I pray. I didn't think it, and I still think they don't. But be that as it may, Kenny smiled from one of his wonderful smiles and says, "You're going to be able to." He said, "That's really great." He said, "I want us to talk about that some more. You're going to be able to help me with God. But let's talk about not drinking. Can you not drink?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You got to stop taking Benny's." How in the hell did he know I was taking Benny's? Unless he noticed I said the same things over and over really fast. Kenny said, because I told him, I said, "I have to make my life work. Man evolved through God's immutable laws of nature, and man somehow reached a level of intelligence where he could discern God as principle in the universe. Then he developed technologies to apply that in his life, whether it was a wheel and gradually fire and more complex until he built a civilization that don't work very good. But it's man's creation. It isn't God's, and God doesn't participate in it. You have to make your own life work." And Kenny said, "Boy, I understand that. When I came to AA, I thought I had to make my life work." He said, "Frank Giroux told me that if that's what I really believe, then I need to come to a lot of meetings. And I got to listen to a lot of people, because these people here seem to know how to make their life work. And you got to listen to them to see what they say that you think you can use in your life to make your life work." And he said, "You got to come to a lot of meetings, because most of the stuff you hear won't make it won't make any sense to you. You won't like it." Well, man, that was the truth. And read the book. I read the book. A lot of stuff wrong in that book when you first read it. Fact is, when you first look at those steps, two of them are completely unnecessary. They're just willingness steps, the sixth and the eighth step. He must have put those in just so it would come out 12 in order to match the number of disciples. This guy seems to be bizarre about 12 anyway. He's got 12 traditions and, looking for symmetry. I understand that, but as far as principle is concerned, you can leave those two out. In fact, you can leave all of them out, except the first half of the first step, and that's what I did. And I went to meetings, and I got drunk one more time. Then on August 4th, 1972, I had my last drink, and I came to AA, and I listened. I stopped drinking, stopped taking Benny's, and I listened. I listened like somebody who already knew it all. Very unusual for a newcomer. But there I was. When you read the steps, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful, my mind would say, cunning is not an attribute that you can assign to an inanimate substance such as alcohol. Alcohol has no intellect, it can therefore have no cunning. They've got that screwed up. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. They just got through saying that alcohol has power. Powerful. Now they're saying God has all power. Well, you can't have that both ways. If God has all power, then alcohol cannot be powerful. And if alcohol is powerful, God don't have all power. He just has all power except the power that alcohol has. I know it. The only problem with this, the fatal flaw here, is that when you're thinking that way, you're missing stuff that could save your life. Ha ha! when you're reading the big book that same way. AA was the only place in the world that I could have come to get the help that I have gotten. All my life, good people had tried to help me, but before they could help me, they had to tell me what was wrong with me. I had to see. And when I was a baby elephant, I came to believe that I'm right. I have to be right, or I fail in school, I fail in heaven, I fail in my family. I have to be right. And so I believe I'm right. And if you don't believe so, you're wrong. And it becomes very important to me. By God, you know you're wrong and I'm right, you know. And I live my life that way. And you got to drink whiskey to make that work, and it don't work. And it came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody, well, that's not true. But very seldom does anybody ever tell me what's wrong with me. Once in a while, I hear people say, for the newcomers, sit down, shut up, and listen. And that, listen, if sit down, shut up, and listen was effective advice, I wouldn't be here. I heard that when I was 3 years old. Sit down, shut up, and listen don't help me. It's the stuff after that that helps me. It's you telling, it's Bob telling his story and me seeing me. Me seeing me. When Lyle is talking about how much effort he put into making his life work, and in order to get it to work, he ended up doing hard time. I was so in that, so in that. And even after I was sober, I was in that. I was having to make my life work. And I came to AA and I heard Norm Alpe say, I wasn't a giver by nature. I was a taker. I was a taker of things and a user of people, a loser. All takers are losers. You're looking at one right here. I remember thinking, that's the best description of me that I've heard in such few words. Now, if Norm would have said, Howard is a taker of things and a user of people, I'd have hated him, I'd have hated you, and I'd have been out of here. But it is, one drunk talking to another, and I'd hear people say, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Start with, we're not drunk, we're alcoholic. Nobody, you know, I had all kinds of stuff going on in my head. I heard a guy say, he was 36 years in learning, that all the people that he hated didn't feel it. Man, that was news to me. But I tried to incorporate that into my life. I heard a guy named Tommy O'Mara say, if you make one mistake and brood about that, you make two mistakes. And I heard Archie Johnson say, I was so busy today wanting what I was getting that I didn't have time to worry about getting what I wanted. And in AA, we learn to live in the now, right now. And whatever's happening right now, love that. Because that's what's going to happen anyway. And not liking it is what's going to be the problem with it. That also applies to this talk. Now, if you think about it, that's a powerful thing to say in an AA meeting. But what my mind said as I listened to this, well, let's stick him in the eye with a sharp stick. Let's see him like that. Let's put his theory to test. Because that's the way I was. But I went outside and it's raining. It's raining as hard as it can rain in Pacific Palisades, California. And I hate the rain. I've hated the rain since I wiped out the wheat crop. And it occurred to me, this is what Archie said. Archie meant love the rain, and you know I loved the rain that night. And when I woke up, it wasn't raining, and I had to make the adjustment. And that gradually had become a part of my life, part of the way I want to live my life. Love what's happening now, because that's what's going to happen anyway. And it isn't easy, you know. Been on this road, I've been on that road of self-centeredness. And I didn't believe, when you said I was self-centered, I didn't believe that. I believe self-centeredness was if I didn't care about my kids, if I didn't care about my wife, if I didn't care about my job, if I didn't care about my country, if all I cared about was myself. And by God, I knew better than that. But in AA, that isn't what self-centeredness means. Self-centeredness means that my problem is I have an insane delusion that my happiness and satisfaction is going to happen because I manage well. That's an insane belief I have. And I lack the power to manage well. I came to AA, and you guys taught me that in the first step. I came to believe, I already believed in God. And I was at a meeting one night, and Don Gates was the speaker, and he says, if you're new and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun. And you'll decide that you're not going to AA meetings anymore. He said, if you don't go to meetings, you'll decide to stop going, to go back in the bar and have a drink. And if you do that, and the bartender says, what's the matter? I thought you was going to AA. Don't AA work? He said, if you're not working the steps, be honest with him and tell him you don't know if AA works or not, because you wouldn't try. There's nothing in my head to pop off about that. I knew that I could not believe that AA won't work unless I work the steps. And that night I made a decision, which for me in retrospect was the third step, to do an inventory. And I did an inventory, and I still have it, and it's a remarkably good inventory for as screwed up as I was. But one of the things that happened was all my life my dad had been my problem. In the 60s, I went to a psychiatrist who helped me see that my dad was my problem. Also, in retrospect, he was trying to show me something else, but I couldn't see anything else. And I did the inventory, and I saw my dad is not my problem. My dad died in 1951 at an AA meeting sober. I was in the Navy, and I wasn't part of his sobriety, but I knew he was going to AA, and he died at an AA meeting of a heart attack, but he never died for me until 1973 when I was doing my inventory. Then he died, and he was no longer the problem. I was the problem. I did a fifth step. That was a big help. And the sixth and seventh step was just in there. You could have taken them out. And but the eighth and the ninth, the eighth is if you're willing to make amends. I never felt willing to make an amend. But my sponsor tracked down the equipment that I'd stolen and Pat. I went home and told Pat what I'd done, and she went to the bank with me, and we borrowed money so that I could go to the machine shop that had the equipment and buy it from them. I didn't make a dime on that deal. I lost money on that deal. Whiskey had stopped making me smart a long time ago. And I took Pat home, and then I took the equipment back. And Kenny had said, don't just take it to the calibration lab. He said, I wouldn't just take it to the calibration lab. I'd take it to the department manager and say, I stole this and I'm bringing it back. I said, God damn, I don't want to. He said, well, you don't have to. He said, you don't have to. But I said, that's what I would do. I'm not telling you what to do, but that's what would work best for me. Well, I took the stupid equipment to the department manager and I said, I stole this thing. But he said, don't tell me that. I started to say, but Tom, he said, just go home. It's quitting time. I'll see you in the morning. When I got back in the morning, he called me in the office and said I had the equipment calibrated. It's in perfect working order. I read the company instructions. They require me to fire anybody that steals from me. There's no provisions for bringing it back. But he said, I've decided this equipment wasn't stolen. If you hadn't have told me anything, I wouldn't have known where it's been. And I've had it calibrated in perfect working order. I have the equipment, and it's my position, if I have it, it wasn't stolen. Isn't that right? And I said, that's right. He said, but don't tell anybody. And I haven't. But the next morning, I woke up with the weight of the world off my back, and I didn't know how much the world was weighing on my back until it was off, and I was free of that. Long about this time, I'd ask, how do you stop hating people? And Patty Hicks says, you can't be hateful and grateful at the same time. And if you're a sober member of AA, there's a basis for gratitude, but you got to work for it. Well, I don't know how to work for it, but parallel to this, I'm not praying. Oh, I'm saying the Lord's Prayer with you. I'm getting it right. King James Version, the Revised King James Version, and Emmett Fox, and I think it's in earth as it is in heaven, and we're sticking to our guns on that. Not that it's important to me to be right. So, wherever I was, that's what happened. I forgot where I was. I was telling everybody I didn't believe in prayer. Prayer don't change anything. Nobody cared what I believed. They would listen. But then they would tell me how the prayer paid off in their life. And one guy said, well, I didn't pray for a long time, but I learned to meditate. And I said, how do you meditate? He said, the best description I know of how we meditate in AA is step 11 and the 12 and 12. Read it carefully. I read it carefully. It was the St. Francis of Assisi prayer, which was just exactly what I was not going to do. And I told him that, and he said, let's read it together. There's some pretty good stuff in there if you have somebody that's read it before read it to you. It says such things as self-examination, prayer, and meditation taken independently enrich your life. But taken together when they are logically interrelated, will form a firm foundation for life. And I don't have a firm foundation for life. Then it talks about positive imagination, picturing your spiritual objective in your mind as yours before you start out the day. And then it says, whatever we're meditating on, look it over carefully. And then in meditation, listen for or look for a deeper meaning of each word and phrase. And I decided to do that, but not with the St. Francis prayer. What I decided to do was look at my life, self-examination. And my first meditations were to bring into my consciousness the truth of my life in January of 1972 when my boss demoted me and was setting me up to fire me. when my wife was leaving me and wanted a divorce, just to get the hell away from me. If you hear Al-Anon talk, it's a ferocious relationship. She wants me to die. She thinks me dying is the solution to her problem. And then she's glad I'm drinking so much because she's not going to have to kill me. All I got, you know. That's what's going on in our life at the time. I'm having convulsive seizures. I'm acutely intoxicated with probable alcoholic neuropathy. I'm a candidate for hard time in a federal penitentiary with my family. Candidates for that disgrace. And there's nothing in my life to stop the plummeting. My life is the character and quality of my life is disintegrating. And there's nothing to stop it. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I breathe that consciousness. I bring that truth into my consciousness. And then I bring the truth in that the deterioration in my life stopped right there. Now my feelings went down the toilet, but my life stopped plummeting and started to make a recovery, started going back up. And I took the equipment back and I had a great feeling. And that was a new baby elephant belief. You see, that was such a good feeling that I never lost it. I don't feel it all the time, but in meditation I could bring it into my consciousness as truth. And as I keep doing this stuff, there's more and more of that. So life is good. And I and my life is working. Pat is going down on she. I was driving her nuts, and she was still thinking about leaving, and one day she said, I'm never going to leave you. I've been thinking about leaving you for 23 years, and I haven't done it, and I'm going to stop thinking about it. We're going to fight, but I ain't going no place. I said, I ain't either. She said, I'm not even going to think about it or threaten it. I said, I ain't either. And she had changed, and I had to do a new inventory. I had to go through the steps again in order to live with her new strength. And I found out things about myself again that I could have never found in the first time I went through the steps. So life is getting better. I'm 9 years sober, and I get promoted to the career goal, to my career goals. And I had made my life work. Everything that I had put in a plan to make happen, I had a retirement plan, I had a savings plan, I had medical coverage, I had everything that I had set in place to happen, happened. And I got promoted to my career goal. I'm on cloud nine for about 15 minutes. And my boss brings in an unbelievably difficult assignment and said, this goes along with the promotion. Dreadful. I dreaded this. It was way beyond my capability to do, and it was so important to the company that they needed to give it to somebody more competent than me. But if I said that, I was saying, you can have the section manager's shop back. And I wasn't willing to do that. In my meditation, I just obsessed on the dreadfulness of this for two or three days. Then on the third day, halfway through the meditation, I meditated. And at the end of the meditation, I felt good in my head. Now, there is a committee, but the more you meditate, the less intrusive the committee is, and the less often it performs, and sometimes when it participates, it's important. And this morning, I felt good at the end of meditation, and I asked, without intending to ask, I just said, why can't I feel this good when I first wake up? Now, there's something in me that answers these questions from time to time, and I never knew what it was, never even worried about what it was. I thought it was me answering my own question. But this answer, as it sometimes does, comes with a vision, or for the newcomer, a fantasy. And I fantasized seeing a frozen lake in Minnesota. And somehow I wonder, you know, you wonder, what the hell is this about? And then it occurs to me that the ice is as thick as the laws of physics will allow the ice to get. And you could put a Sherman tank out on that ice and it would support it. And I'm wondering, what the hell is that about? And then it occurs to me that walking across the lake a step at a time would be a good metaphor for living my life a day at a time. Be careful, because it's slippery. See, a voice, after I had this picture, a thought came to me, or a voice or something, and it said that. Be careful, because it's slippery. And by the way, Howard, if you're not convinced the ice is thick enough to support you, you're going to dread every step of the way. Now, I didn't try to shape that. And gradually, my working the steps and many of the experiences I've had through working the steps fit in with this idea. And I knew I have to come to believe that God, what this message is that I don't believe that God's a part of my life, and I must come to believe that. And I really don't believe it. Maybe I'll start with the book again. And I started, and I got clear up to where, once again, it's talking about the Wright brothers and how their faith is a cornerstone. And every time I had read that, without me knowing it, my head had said, faith, nah. These guys were developing aeronautical engineering. They had wind tunnels with little airfoils and letter scales that measured the lift, and then they scaled that up. That's what they were doing. And then I realized, that's not the tall pole in this tent. He's just using that as a metaphor. He's got another point. And if you invalidate his metaphor, then you're invalidating his point. And I saw that. Isn't that a wonderful thing after 9 years for me to see? Who thinks I'm a quick study? And I say, I'm going to read We Agnostics again, and I start back over, trying to be aware of how I'm reading and what I'm thinking. And I come to page 48 and 49. The prosaic steel girders are made up of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speeds in accordance with precise law. Science tells us so, and we have no reason to doubt it. I read that and I think, electrons don't primarily whirl around electrons. They whirl around protons and neutrons. Now, that's not, he's not, you know, and it. I never knew I did that every time I read it. You see, I already knew it all, and I read stuff like I already knew it all. And then I would invalidate the next thing. So I read the next thing, and now I have taken this out of context. And it is the foundation of my spiritual life. And I am open to strengthening this belief as truth. The perfectly logical assumption is that underneath the material world and life as we see it, not just the biochemical life, but the circumstances and events of life, the character and quality of the circumstances and events, there is an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence. There is no separation between me and the spirit of the universe that underlies the totality of things. And God is immutable law. The immutable laws of nature and immutable spiritual laws, which are embedded in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that when we do these, our life will experience a lift, just like the aerodynamics when a plane flies. The laws of aerodynamics, if things are right, the plane's going to fly, and my life is going to be lifted. And God don't have to change anything because that happened. And when I pray to know that as a fundamental truth. I'm not asking that anything be changed. I'm just trying to change my not seeing it. I wasn't even good at it, but as that became part of my life, this terrible assignment fell together like magic and made me look good, and that's important. As other problems came up, it was like my life became like magic. My boss retired, and I got his job. There were a lot of people fighting to get that job. I wasn't fighting for it. I did, because I kind of was looking to retire. They asked me to take the job, and of course I took it, and I didn't retire, and I stayed for another 3 years. And now as the manager of the systems engineering department in the helicopter design division on the Apache helicopters, just a tremendous job, and I look back on it with a great sense of well-being with my career. There was difficult assignments. I mean stuff that the big guys had trouble with that I did. One day my boss called me in. He said, I'm a great people picker. I picked your old boss to have that department, and I picked you. And that assignment you just did, you did that as good as Tom did. Well, man, I could not have had it. I didn't want what you guys had. I wanted what Tom had. And I went out and sat in my car, and my head said, he said, you have what Tom had. My dad's in the committee. My dad said, you don't have what Tom had. He's a better engineer. He's a better manager. He's better looking. He's a hell of a lot better people person. Then the voice said, that may be true, but I think Tom always took it for granted, and you take it for grace. Man, I didn't know that till I heard that, and I know that's true. I know I'm a long ways from being humble, because anytime I'm humble, anytime I believe, anytime I'm getting my sense of well-being from a conviction of the presence of divine order in my life and good things happen, then I start relying on the good things happening in order for me to have my good feeling. You know, and it's hard to stay ahead of the power curve. But Pat and I just took a 3-week vacation, and I got ahead of the power curve again, and I'd like to not get behind it, you know? I'd like to always have the power in the engine to make damn sure it flies, but sometimes I just take on too much weight, you know, and it won't lift off. But we took a vacation, and then the magic things happened to solve all the problems. It was something that you can't make happen. You just have to live this life and believe, and it happened. I was reading a book on meditation. I've read a lot of them, and one of my favorites says, wherever you find God, that is right for you. If you convince yourself of God's existence through analysis, that's the right way for you. Or if in living your life you just feel God's presence and power, that is right for you. But remember, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. I read that Alcoholics Anonymous is my window. This is my spot. This is where I find God. What a deal. I love you for that.